Introduce our main speaker for the evening, Elizabeth from San Diego.
I'm Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to wish happy birthdays to the two who took birthdays today, Denise and Bill, and to all the others who didn't, who had birthdays this month, Juliet and Kit and Stephanie. Happy birthday to you, too. And I also want to thank Laura for asking me to speak. I didn't know if I would be able to do it, actually. I have spoken many times from a podium over the years of my sobriety, but I've never told this story. And so I hope I brought some notes. I hope you'll bear with me. So what she said. Really, right? I mean, I don't know how to add, you know, I didn't drink almost at all until I was 23 or 24. I mean, I was in high school in the late 60s and in college in the early 70s, and nobody drank. It wasn't, you know, any big credit. That just wasn't what we did. But when I got to, into the workplace, it was in the days when people were still drinking martini lunches, and it was just wonderful. Oh, I was so nervous and so insecure and so out of place and so not okay all the time. And then I discovered alcohol, and it was just, you know, I don't know if it was the first drink or the second drink or the, but certainly by the third drink, I just had this, and it just, you know, and now instead of it being about me being nervous, it was just about what a jerk you were, and it was just fabulous, you know. And so I did just like what the book says. I had, you know, I was the woman alcoholic, and I just augured in really fast. I drank for 6 years. And in those 6 years, I destroyed everything that I had worked to build to that point. I had gotten in a very serious car accident, broke my neck, broke my arm, broke my leg. I was in traction. Drunk driving accident. I'd been drinking all afternoon. And obviously hadn't had enough, so we were going back to my house to have more when the bars closed. And I was on Pershing. Do you know when you come, when you know how Pershing's that sort of off-ramp? And the back end of my Datsun B210, you know, bad driving. I just took the turn badly. The back end of my Datsun B210 dropped into the little, like, water culvert, and I way overcorrected, and I just drove down the slope and crashed into 3 palm trees. So, like, right, I think that might have been my fault. What do you think? So, pretty sure that was my fault. But they arrested me on the emergency room table for drunk driving, where I refused the breathalyzer. And I seriously considered suing the people who had aligned my front end, because I was sure that that's what the problem was. I have endless stories like that. I mean, I was just like what the book talks about, I just could not distinguish the true from the false. My husband had moved to Los Angeles to do work, and I'd moved the boyfriend into the house, and the husband was coming back from Los Angeles, thought maybe he'd move back into his house, and so I checked into the alcohol rehab. Let them figure out who's going to live in the house. I figured. I wish I were kidding. I'm not kidding. My story goes on and on. You know, I swear only in AA do we think that's a funny story. Everywhere else, it's disgraceful and shameful what I did, the things I did. And I knew it. And I couldn't live with myself. And so I drank more to squash the feelings of shame and remorse. Every morning I would wake up and I'd say, okay, today is the day I'm not going to drink. Today is the day I'm going to go to work. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to come home. I'm going to make myself a little dinner. I'm going to go to bed. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. Anyway, so I'm in the alcohol rehab. They give you Valium every morning and every night. And so every morning and every night, I tucked the Valium in between my cheek and my gum, and I had a little tinfoil back in my hospital room, and I would put it in this little tinfoil, and then on Sunday night, I took it all and got stoned. So that was me and the alcohol rehab. And I obviously had nowhere to move after the 28 days, so I went to a recovery home. And I don't know, lots of people talk about AA and they say, you know, I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was home. Yeah, well, that wasn't me. No. I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought, oh my God, it has come to this. They took my keys to my car at the recovery home. They put me on probation. I'm 30 years old. Are you serious? And so, not surprisingly, 60 days later, I had my slip, which involved taking drugs. I had a pass, a weekend pass. They finally let me off probation. I had a weekend pass. I went back to my house, and I found these mood, like, antidepressant-type drugs. I didn't even know I had them. And I looked at my husband was a physician, and so I looked it up in the physician's desk reference what the therapeutic dose was. It said it was between 75 and 125 milligrams, and they were 25 milligrams each, so I dropped four in my hand and took 100 milligrams. And nothing happened, so I took four more, and I took four more, and then I took four more, and now I'm like my memory, you know, that kind of like snapshot thing that happens. I never really blacked out, I just sort of would like snapshot. So that snapshot thing was starting to happen. And I stopped dead in my dining room and I said, oh my God, I am an alcoholic. Because I hadn't intended to take. Well, anyway, so I ended up in the emergency room on an overdose. So my slip involved an overdose. And they locked me up in the psych ward and the psychiatrist had me drink black charcoal and Epicac and this stuff kills you, apparently, if you overdose on it. And the psychiatrist said to me, why did you try to kill yourself? And I was like, I didn't try to kill myself. I was just trying to get high. And it finally happened for me. You know, the book talks about kind of the step before the first step, where it says, you know, we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. And then it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. I was there. And it was like the joke's on me because I really, really didn't like you guys. I mean, really. I didn't like the people that stood at the door and greeted you. And they'd be like, what? Hi, welcome to our meeting. I'm like, well, you don't even know me. Why are you welcoming to me? I mean, so the whole thing was gross. Oh, and I had to, but you guys knew how not to drink, and I didn't. And you guys knew how not to do drugs, and I didn't know how to do that. So I came back for the sole purpose of doing that. And I wasn't going to make it. I was about 9 months into that, like, thing. And Clancy came to speak at the Old Town speaker meeting. And he said something that really changed my life. He said, if your problem is alcohol, you've come to the wrong place. If your problem is alcohol, may I suggest you stop drinking. But if your problem is you can't live comfortably without alcohol, then we have something for you here. And so I thought, all right, I guess I have to find a power greater than myself. I didn't believe in God at all. And this whole talk is going to be about trying to stay in conscious contact with a power greater than myself through everything, like what Michelle was talking about, through all the ups and downs of life. My sobriety date is August 1st, 1983, and I rolled up my sleeves and got to work in AA. And I couldn't believe in a God. I still don't believe in a God that has a plan. I never did get to that place. I don't have a God that finds me parking spaces. None of that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, I envy you, honestly, if that's your God. I wish I had that. That's fabulous, but I never could do that. But I would go running every morning, and I would smell the dew on grass in the morning, and it smelled so good, and it was so clean, and it was so clear to me that I didn't do that, that I could see that as a power greater than myself. And I grew from there. And, you know, I just said about the husband left me for absolutely good reasons, honestly. And I ended up having two kids with the boyfriend. And at 6 years sober, my whole life fell apart. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. I was doing all the things that I was supposed to do. I was being sponsored. I was sponsoring. I had commitments. I did service work. But I hadn't yet learned that it was possible to be living life on self-will and having good motives. I didn't know that yet. And I learned that at 6 years sober. And I didn't know how to do it any differently. I really didn't. So my sponsor at the time is a woman named Kathy, just a wonderful woman. She and her friend Patricia just basically took me under their wing. And I would show up with my two little kids and a sleeping bag and a pizza, and I would say to Kathy, just put me to work. And she would give me her laundry to fold. I was just so grateful for something to do. And she showed me, she modeled for me what a sober life, what a life living in accordance with a set of spiritual principles looked like. I thought, I don't know, the clouds were supposed to part and the sunlight of the Spirit was supposed to shine down on me, and I would hear the angels singing, and God and I would, you know, walk off into the sunset, you know, with two sets of footprints. Never worked like that for me. What it worked like for me was like, God would come at me with a 2x4 and go, up the side of the head, and I go, oh, okay, I think I'm supposed to let go now. You know, I'm a very slow learner, as my story is going to show you. But I started to see that living life in accordance with a set of spiritual principles was living life in the little things, putting the shopping cart back, being courteous to the bank teller. This was back in the day when there were bank tellers. You know, all of that sort of stuff. And I'm grateful for those lessons. I'm so grateful for that. And my life started, you know, I was a single mom, and I remember praying to God saying, if it is your will for me that I should be a single mom and live by myself without a mate, I'll do it that way. That's the way I'll do it. And he introduced me to Brian, just the greatest guy. Just, I don't know why he picked me, but man, I was so glad. and then like 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened. It was 9/11 happened, and then 2 days later, my sponsor Kathy's son was murdered. He was murdered. And those two things, like, boom, boom, right up next to each other, boom, boom, and just like it ripped the rug out from under my conscious contact with a power greater than myself. I just could not make any sense of it. How am I doing? And so I talked and talked and talked and talked. I'm so grateful for my friends and the community of women in Alcoholics Anonymous who just held me up and listened to me go on and on and on about not understanding how a God of this universe could let people in the Twin Towers, good people, God-fearing people, people with families, would let them have to choose between burning to death or falling to their death. Like, I couldn't get the images out of my mind of the people falling from the sky. I mean, it was just crazy making. Like, what kind of God would do this? I was without ideas. And I talked and talked and talked. I'm so grateful that people let you tell the truth in AA. And finally, I started to see what Michelle talked about. Like I said, what she said. I started to see how much of my belief in a power greater than myself was deeply embedded in the idea that if I do good things, if I'm a good person, if I drop good acts into that coin slot of the vending machine and pull the lever, God's going to drop a good life out the bottom for me. And I didn't know I believed in that kind of God. And I started to see, oh, that's what's going on. And so I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful for the second step, because the second step, oh, I get to do the second step over and over and over again. I get to come to believe over and over and over again as life's circumstances change me and challenge me. So I finally understood the idea of letting go. I finally got the idea that I do the footwork and I leave the results to God. I'd heard it for years and years and years by then in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it finally made that long journey, you know, from the head to the heart. And so this is where I would usually end my talk. I would always end my talk by saying, I have two children who've never seen me drink or use drugs. I'm married to the man of my dreams. I adore him, and he loves me. I have a good career. I have loving friends. I have been blessed beyond my wildest dreams. And that would be the end of my story. And I'd sit down, and people would applaud. But Brian died on August 13th. And so now I got a new story. And I swear to you, I don't know how it ends. It's really hard, though. It's a really hard story now. So I'm going to try and tell you what I've learned over the last 9 months. Because it's been really hard. I mean, really hard. Okay. I'm going to take a breath. Sorry. I really didn't want to cry. What are the chances? So I went up to visit my sister and her husband. My parents were worried about me. My parents are still with us, 93 and 96. Yeah. Brian died at 70. Can you imagine? So I wanted them to see that I was okay, so I held it all together for them. But then I went to my sister's house, and I was laying on my sister's couch talking to her husband, Rod. And I said, Rod, I don't think I can live without Brian. I don't think I can do it. And everybody I had said that to before Rod said, sure you can, you're strong, you have a support group. But Rod said, I think you're right. I don't think you can live without Brian, because you're Brian's wife, and Brian's wife can't live without Brian. You have to become somebody else. And I thought, oh, that's true. Oh my God, that's true. And I've had to do it before. When I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a woman who couldn't not drink. And I don't have to drink today, ever, no matter what. How did that happen? I was changed. That's how that happened. And I thought, I've done this before. I know how to do this. I have steps. I have a power greater than myself. I have the AA community. Oh my God, I can do this. I didn't think I could, but then I thought, I can. So I'd like to tell you what I've learned about the kindness of people, what I've learned about the uncertainty of life, the groundlessness of it, what I've learned about the strength of my desire for certainty, and the lengths to which I will go to spin stories to pretend like there's certainty. And about finding the divine at the very, very center of my daily experience of living. So I'm going to start with talking about the kindness of my friends. Brian was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and my sister got in her car, and she drove down from L.A. 5 of the 6 weekends that Brian was in the hospital. All 7 of our kids were a blended family. We have 7 children. All 7 of our kids flew down and visited him in the hospital and came to stay with me. Juliet opened up her house to me twice, not once, twice, for weeks at a time. Me and my cat, which is above and beyond. Doreen, who's not here tonight, went with me to the hospice team meeting. The hospice team meeting. Yeah. Can you imagine that? Kit helped me move over and over. How many times did I move? I don't even know. Supported me the whole time Brian was sick. Michelle and Bill went to a Alzheimer's support group with me because I couldn't bring myself to go. They said, well, we'll go. They went with me. My cousin flew down from the Bay Area. She just showed up at my weekend, the first weekend after Brian died, just because she didn't want me to be alone that weekend. I mean, the list is endless. It just goes on and on and on. I would take up the whole time I have less telling you how many people helped me. And I want to tell you about what I've learned about the uncertainty of life. I can't sleep. I wake up at 3:30 in the morning, the head going. And so instead of laying there and just like thinking, I listen to podcasts. And I've been listening to a lot of spiritual speakers. It's just wonderful how much there is. And I heard a woman talk about Alice in Wonderland. She talked about when Alice in Wonderland fell down the rabbit hole. And she said the most courageous thing about that was she didn't grab onto the walls to stop her fall. She just went into free fall. And she didn't look around until she got where she was going. And that's what I'm doing. I'm in free fall. And I'm just going to keep falling until a path is revealed to me. Because I believe what our book says. I believe our book when it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. I believe that. It has been my experience. After 9/11 and my sponsor's son was killed, I finally understood that I do the footwork and I leave the results to God. But what I've been learning lately is that it's actually much more challenging than that. I have to let go of who I think I am, what I think my path is, and the outcome. Honestly, this thing has just blown a hole in my life. I don't know how to live life without my loving husband. I've been with him for 28 years. Most of my sobriety. All that laughter, and he was a really funny guy. He would just make so much fun of me. And I was such an easy target because I took myself so very, very seriously. He would just do outrageous things. I can't tell you them from a podium. But they were very, very fun. A vision for you says it all, I think. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. I remember when I was newly sober, I was up in Carlsbad at a speaker meeting. I was maybe 9 or 10 months sober. And I had gone up to Carlsbad with a group of friends to go to a speaker meeting, and I couldn't sit still. And I just got up and left the meeting and went out and sat on the steps of the church where the meeting was. And I was sobbing because I had no idea what it means to abandon yourself to God. But I think I do now. I think I do. everything is not going to be okay. You know, Michelle's got a year coming up that's going to be nasty. It's going to be hard. And we're going to bring her food, and we're going to, you know, ice her feet and her hands. But she's going to do it. We can't do it for her, you know. Everything is not going to be okay. Brian's dead. So what does it mean in circumstances like this? I remembered a time when Brian and I were in Paris. We were at the Charles de Gaulle Airport, and there was this huge strike, and we needed to get from the domestic airline terminal to the international airline terminal. And there was no way to get there. You could not get from here to there. The buses were all on strike. The taxis were all on strike. I mean, everybody was on some sympathy strike or other. And our plane, you know, the time for our plane came and went, and we needed to get home. I had two kids, and the babysitting, like, stopped at a time certain. You know what I mean? I need to be there. And I was panicking. I was just, like, starting to spin in my typical Elizabeth spin-out fashion. And Brian said, well, the way I look at it, we need to be in the international terminal. And so we got up and started walking. It was 5 kilometers. That's not that far, 5 kilometers. It's, what, 3.1 miles? That's not bad. We walked. We made it to the international terminal. The path reveals itself as we walk. You know, I was all in with Brian. I was all in. I remember the day I went all in. I remember it clear as bell. You know, we had 7 kids, and so you can imagine there were children underfoot all the time. But every once in a very great while, the schedules would all line up, and we would have the house to ourselves. So it was one of those days, and we had a lovely afternoon. Say no more. And the sun was coming in through the bedroom window, and kind of, it was the afternoon, it was kind of heating us up, and I felt my heart huge, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I love this guy. I couldn't take it if he left me. And I could feel my heart starting to close up. I could just feel it. It was all like starting to defend up. I could just feel it shutting down and shutting down, and I went, no, no, I am not going to shut this out. I'm all in. And I did. I went all in. Nothing could have prepared me for this loss. I'm convinced. I will be forever changed because of it. But I've said it before, and I'll say it right now. If I had it to do all over, I'd do it just the way I did. I wouldn't miss a minute of it. It was fantastic. It really was, too. Lots of you know him. I am not uniquely targeted for this staggering loss. I have gone to bereavement groups. They have been enormously helpful to me. They have been helpful to me in the way that coming to AA is helpful to me. I look around and I see so many people who have suffered terrible, terrible losses. And it's not like misery loves company. It's not that. It's that I understand that this is a human thing that's happening. This is a human condition. God has not targeted me for this. These things happen. And I said to myself, well, I was all in with Brian. You know what? I want to be all in with life. I don't want this to stop me. I want to be all in. There's no guarantee. There's no certainty. Thank you. The sixth and seventh step talk about humility, and they talk about character building for character building's sake alone. And if I've learned anything at all, this is what I've learned most, that I practice these principles in all my affairs for the sake of practicing these principles in all my affairs, and not because I'm going to get anything. Nothing is promised me. I learned a meditation prayer when the grief hits, it feels like an elephant standing on my chest. It's unbelievably difficult. And I learned a meditation that helped me enormously. It's called Tonglen meditation, and it has three components. So the first component is other people feel this pain too. And I breathe that, and I believed that. It was easy for me to say that. And the second component was, and I pray for them that they should find a path through this pain to enlightenment. And I had no problem saying that. I do pray for all those people I met in those bereavement groups and for everyone in this room suffering, because we all carry something, I know, that you should find a path through the pain to enlightenment. And then the third component was, and if I could take their suffering from them, I would. And I couldn't say that. I couldn't say that. And 6 months to the day after my husband passed away, I was on email, and I opened up an email from my girlfriend, Lisa, and it said her husband, Chris, had died suddenly of cancer. And my first thought was, oh, my God, Lisa, if I could take these 6 months from you, I would. I know how to do them. See, we're changed. It's unbelievable. Prayer changes us. I don't know how. I don't get it. Honestly, I don't get any of what I'm talking about, but I have experienced this, and I know what I am saying is true. Like Brian said, the way I see it, we need to be at the international terminal. Let's start walking, and the path will appear as we walk. I know it's true. We just start walking. We live our life the best we can, in accordance with a set of spiritual principles, and the path appears. I was driving the other day on 52. I was going east on 52. It was late in the afternoon. The light was golden. You know how it gets late in the afternoon. It was gold. It was warm. There was a lot of traffic, so there wasn't any, you know, jockeying for position. I was just, you know, driving with the flow of traffic, you know. So I didn't have to think about anything. I was just driving along, and I didn't have the radio. It was peaceful, and I was just driving. And all of a sudden, I had this intense feeling of Brian's presence and his absence at the same time. And I could feel myself moving towards the presence and trying to defend myself up against the absence. And I said, no, stay, stay. Stay. And the wave came and it crashed like it always does, and then it receded like it always does, and then I was just driving again. That's the truth of it. And in that moment, when I was able to stay in all those crazy big feelings, just be right here, right now, like we talk about, I had a minute of the divine in that car. And I think that's what we do. I think we just stay right in the center of the herd. We hold each other up through really hard times and really good times. And we become the kind of people that we're proud of. You know, we're sober and we're proud of ourselves because we give just a little bit more than we take every day.